of the third night, Mary arrived at the cottage, stood in the doorway, and made the dreaded announcement. A visit from Dr. Matthews had been arranged for the following night. Mary lowered her voice and clasped Eliza's hands. If there was any part of her that thought to keep the baby, she must go now. She must take the child and run. But although the suggestion of escape knotted itself to Eliza's heart, tugged sharply and willed her to action, she hurriedly untied it. She ignored the sharp ache in her chest and reassured Mary, as she had before, that she knew her own mind. She looked down at her child one last time, stared and stared at the perfect little face, tried to comprehend that she had made it, that she had done this wonderful thing, until finally the throbbing in her head, her heart, her soul was unbearable. And then somehow, as if watching herself from afar, she did as she had promised, handed the tiny girl over and allowed her to be taken, closed the door after Mary, and returned alone to the silent, lifeless cottage. And as dawn came to the wintry garden, and the walls of the cottage receded again, Eliza realized that she had never known the black ache of loneliness before. Though she despised Linus's man, Mansell, had cursed his name when he'd brought Eliza into their lives, Adeline couldn't dispute that the man knew how to find people. 4 days had passed since his dispatch to London, and this afternoon, as she'd pretended to embroider in the morning room, Adeline had been summoned to the telephone. Mansell, at the other end of the line, was mercifully discreet. One never knew who might be listening on another extension. "I telephone Lady Maltrichet to let you know that some of the goods you require have now been collected." Adeline's breath caught in her throat. So soon. Anticipation, hope, nerves set her fingertips to tingling. "And may I inquire, is it the larger item or the smaller that you have in your possession?" "The larger." Adeline's eyelids fell closed. She flattened the relief, the joy from her voice. "And when will you make delivery?" "We leave London immediately. I will arrive at Blackhurst tomorrow evening." Thus had Adeline waited. Thus was she waiting still, pacing the Turkish rug, smoothing her skirts, snapping at the servants, as all the while she plotted Eliza's dispense. Eliza had agreed never to go near the house, and she didn't. But she watched. And she found that even when she had saved sufficient funds to book passage on a ship, travel to distant lands, something stopped her. It was as if with the birth of the baby, the anchor Eliza had been seeking all her life had lodged into the earth of Blackhurst. The child's pull was magnetic, and so she stayed. But she kept her promise to Rose and avoided the house, found other places to hide from which to observe, just as she had as a girl, lying on the shelf in Mrs. Swindle's tiny upstairs room, watching as the world moved around her and she remained motionless, outside the action. For with the loss of the child, Eliza found that she had fallen through the center of her old life, her old self. She had forsaken her birthright and, in the process, forfeited the purpose in her life. She wrote rarely, only one fairy tale that she deemed worthy of inclusion in the collection. A story about a young woman who lived alone in a dark wood, who made the wrong decision for the right reason, and destroyed herself in the process. Pale months formed long years. Then one summer's morning in 1913, the book of fairy tales arrived from the publisher. Eliza took it inside immediately, tore the packaging to reveal the leather-bound treasure within. She sat in the rocking chair, opened the book, and lifted it close to her face. It smelled of fresh ink and binding glue, just like a real book. and there, inside, were her stories, her dear creations. She turned the thick, fresh pages, tale by tale, until she came to the crone's eyes. She read it through, and as she progressed, she remembered the strange, vivid dream in the garden, the all-pervasive sense that the child inside her was important to the story. And Eliza knew suddenly that the child, her child, must possess a copy of the tale, that the two were connected somehow. So she wrapped the book in brown paper, awaited her opportunity, then did what she had promised not to, breached the gate at the end of the maze, and approached the house. Dust motes, hundreds of them, danced in a sliver of sunlight that had appeared between two barrels. The little girl smiled, and the authoress, the cliff, the maze, Mama, left her thoughts. She held out a finger, tried to catch a speck upon it, laughed at the way the motes came so close before skirting away. The noises behind her hiding spot were changing. The little girl could hear the hubbub of movement, voices laced with excitement. She leaned into the veil of light and pressed her face against the cool wood of the barrels. With one eye, she looked upon the decks. Legs and shoes and petticoat hems. The tails of colored paper streamers flicking this way and that. Wily gulls hunting the decks for crumbs. A lurch, and the huge boat groaned, long and low from deep within its belly. Vibrations passed through the deck boards and into the little girl's fingertips. A moment of suspension, and she found herself holding her breath, palms flat beside her. Then the boat heaved, pushed itself away from the dock. The horn bellowed, and there was a wave of cheering, cries of bon voyage. They were on their way. They arrived in London by night. Darkness sagged thick and heavy in the folds of the street as they made their way from the train station towards the river. The little girl was tired. Eliza had had to wake her when they reached their destination. But she didn't complain. She held Eliza's hand and followed close to her clipping heels. That night, the two shared a supper of broth and bread in their room. They were both tired from the travel, and little was spoken. Each merely eyed the other, somewhat curiously, over her spoon. The little girl asked once after her mother and father, but Eliza said only that they would be met at the other end of the voyage. It was an untruth, but it was necessary. Time would be required to decide how best to break the news of Rose and Nathaniel's deaths. After supper, Ivory fell quickly to sleep on the room's only bed, and Eliza sat in the window seat. She watched alternately the dark street, jostling with busy wayfarers, and the sleeping child, stirring lightly beneath the sheet. As time passed, Eliza edged nearer the child, observed the small face at ever closer range, until finally she knelt gently beside the bed, so close that she could feel the girl's breath in her hair, could count the tiny freckles on the sleeping face. And what a perfect face it was, how glorious the ivory skin and rosebud lips. It was the same face, Eliza realized, the same wise expression she had gazed upon in the first days of the child's life. The same face that she had seen so often since in her nightly dreams. She was gripped then by an urge, a need, a love, she supposed it was, so ferocious that each grain of herself was infused with certainty. It was as if her own body recognized this child to whom she had given life, as readily as she recognized her own hand, her own face in a mirror, her own voice in the dark. As carefully as she could, Eliza lay upon the bed and curled her own body to accommodate the sleeping girl. Just as she had done in another time, in another room, against the warm body of her brother Sammy. Finally, Eliza was home. On the day the ship was due to leave, Eliza and the girl went early in search of supplies. Eliza purchased a few items of clothing, a hairbrush, and a suitcase in which to house them. At the bottom of the case, she tucked an envelope containing some banknotes and a piece of paper advising of Mary's address in Polperro. It was as well to be safe as sorry. The suitcase was just the right size for a child to carry, and Ivory was thrilled. She clutched it tightly as Eliza led her along the crowded dock. Movement and noise were everywhere, whistling locomotives, billowing steam, cranes lifting baby carriages, bicycles, and phonographs on board. Ivory laughed when they passed a procession of bleating goats and sheep being herded into the ship's hold. She was dressed in the prettiest of the two dresses Eliza had bought for her, and looked quite the part of the wealthy little girl come to see her aunt off on a long sea voyage. When they reached the gangway, Eliza handed her boarding card to the officer. "Welcome aboard, madam," he said, nodding so that his uniform cap bobbed. Eliza nodded in return. "It's a pleasure to have passage booked on your splendid ship," she said. "My niece has been beside herself with excitement for her aunt. Look, she's even brought her own little pretend case." "You like big boats, do you, miss?" The officer peered down at the little girl. Ivory nodded and smiled sweetly, but she said nothing, just as Eliza had instructed. "Officer," said Eliza, "my brother and sister-in-law are waiting further along the dock." She waved into the growing crowd. "I don't suppose you'd mind if I take my little niece on board for a minute to show her my cabin." The officer glanced at the line of passengers now snaked along the dock. "We shan't be long," said Eliza, "only it would mean so very much to the child." "I'd say it should be all right," he said. "Just be sure and bring her back." He winked at Ivory. "I've a feeling her parents would miss her if she left home without them." Eliza took Ivory's hand and headed up the gangway. There were people everywhere. Busy voices, splashing water, foghorns. The ship's orchestra played a jaunty tune on deck, while chambermaids scurried in all directions, postboys delivered telegrams, and self-important bellboys carried chocolates and gifts for the departing passengers. But Eliza didn't follow the chief steward inside the ship. Instead, she led Ivory along the deck, stopping only when they reached a set of wooden barrels. Eliza ushered the girl behind them and crouched so that her skirts draped across the decking. The little girl was distracted. She had never seen such activity and was moving her head about, this way and that. "You must wait here," said Eliza. "It isn't safe to move." "I'll be back soon." She hesitated, glanced skyward. Gulls were skimming overhead, black eyes watchful. "Wait for me. Do you hear?" The little girl nodded. "You know how to hide?"
"Of course."
"It's a game we're playing." As Eliza said the words, Sammy appeared inside her mind, and her skin cooled.
"I like games."
Eliza pushed the image aside. This little girl wasn't Sammy. They weren't playing the Ripper. Everything would be well. "I'll come back for you."
"Where are you going?"
"There's someone I have to see. Something I have to collect before the ship leaves."
"What is it?"
"My past," she said. "My future." She smiled briefly. "My family." As the carriage hurtled towards Blackhurst, Eliza's fog began to lift. Awareness seeped slowly. A rocking motion, the muddy thud of hooves, a musty smell. She cracked open her eyes, blinked. Black shadows dissolved into patches of dusty light, a swooning sensation as her vision focused. There was someone with her, a man sitting opposite. His head was tilted against the leather seat, and a slight snore flecked his steady inhalations. He had a bushy moustache and a pair of armless spectacles perched on the bridge of his nose. Eliza drew breath. She was 12 years old, being dragged from all she knew towards the unknown future. Locked in a carriage with Mother's bad man. Mansell. And yet, it didn't feel quite right. There was something she was forgetting. A dark, humming cloud on the edge of her mind. Something important. Something she had to do. She gasped. Where was Sammy? He should be with her. He was hers to protect. Horses' hooves thudding on the ground outside. The sound made her frightened, ill, though she knew not why. The dark cloud began to swirl. It was coming closer. Eliza's gaze dropped to her skirt, her hands folded on her lap. Her hands, and yet surely not hers at all. Bright light broke through a hole in the cloud. She wasn't 12 at all. She was a grown woman. What had happened? Where was she? Why was she with Mansell? A cottage on a cliff. A garden. The sea. Her breaths were louder now, sharp in her throat. A woman. A man. A baby. Free-floating panic plucked at her skin. More light. The cloud was fading, coming apart. Words. Snatches of meaning. Maryborough. A ship. A child, not Sammy, a little girl. Eliza's throat was raw. A hole opened up inside her, filled quickly with black fear. The little girl was hers. Clarity, so bright it burned. Her daughter was alone on a departing ship. Panic infused her every pore. Her pulse hammered in her temples. She needed to get away, get back. Eliza glanced sideways at the door. The carriage travelled quickly, but she didn't care. The ship left dock today, and the little girl was on it. The child. Her child. All alone. Chest aching, head thumping, Eliza reached out. Mansell stirred. His bleary eyes opened, focused quickly on Eliza's arm, the handle beneath her fingers. A cruel smile began to form on his lips. She gripped the lever. He lunged to stop her, but Eliza was faster. Her need was greater, after all. And she was falling. The cage door had opened, and she fell towards the cold, dark earth. Time folded over on itself. All moments were one. Past was present, was future. Eliza didn't close her eyes. She watched the earth coming closer, the smell of mud, grass, hope. And she was flying, wings outstretched across the surface of the ground, and higher now on the current of the breeze, her face cool, her mind clear. And Eliza knew where she was going, flying towards her daughter, towards Ivory, the person she had spent a lifetime seeking, her other half. She was whole at last, heading towards home. Chapter 49, Cliff Cottage, 2005. Finally, she was in the garden again. Between the bad weather, Ruby's arrival, and the visit to Clara's house, it had been days since Cassandra had been able to slip beneath the wall. She'd been subject to an odd restlessness that had only now dissipated. It was strange, she thought, easing a glove onto her right hand. She'd never considered herself much of a gardener, but this place was different. She felt compelled to return, to plunge her hands into the earth and bring the garden back to life. Cassandra paused as she straightened the fingers of the other glove, noticed again the band of white skin around her finger, second from the left. She ran her thumb over the strip of skin. It was very smooth, more elastic than that either side, as if it had been soaking in warm water. That white band was the youngest part of her, 15 years younger than the rest. Hidden from the moment Nick had slipped the ring onto her finger, it was the only part that hadn't changed, aged, moved on. Until now. Cold enough for you? Kristen, who had just appeared from beneath the wall, thrust his hands deep into the pockets of his jeans. Cassandra pushed the glove on and smiled at him. I didn't think it got cold in Cornwall. All the brochures I read talked about a temperate climate. Temperate compared to Yorkshire. He returned a lopsided smile. It's a taste of the winter ahead. At least you won't have to suffer that. Silence drew out between them. As Christian turned to inspect the hole he'd been digging the week before, Cassandra pretended to be engrossed in her weeding fork. Her return to Australia was a subject they'd avoided discussing. Over the last few days, whenever conversation threatened to skirt the topic, one of them had been quick to set it on a new course. "I was thinking some more," said Christian, "about that letter from Harriet Swindle." "Yeah?" Cassandra pushed aside unsettling thoughts of past and future. "Whatever it was in the clay pot, the one Eliza pulled out of the chimney, it must have been important. Nell was already on the boat, so Eliza took a huge risk going back for it." They had covered this yesterday. In a warm booth at the pub, with the fire crackling in the corner, they'd gone over and over the details as they knew them, seeking a conclusion they both sensed was staring them in the face. "I guess she didn't count on the man being there to abduct her, whoever he was." Cassandra plunged her fork into the flower bed. "I wish Harriet had given us his name." "He must have been someone sent by Rose's family." "You reckon?" "Who else would have been so desperate to get them back?" "Get Eliza back." "Huh?" Cassandra glanced over her shoulder at him. "They didn't get Nell back, only Eliza." Christian paused in his digging. "Yeah, that's odd. I guess she didn't tell them where Nell was." That was the part that didn't make sense to Cassandra. She'd lain awake half the night running the threads through her mind, coming always to the same conclusion. Eliza might not have wanted Nell to remain at Blackhurst, but surely when she learned that the ship had sailed without her, she'd have been desperate to stop it. She was Nell's mother. She'd loved her enough to take her in the first place. Wouldn't she have done everything she could to alert people to the fact that Nell was on a ship, alone? She wouldn't just have said nothing and left a treasured daughter to travel by herself to Australia. Cassandra's fork hit a particularly stubborn root. "I don't think she could tell them." "How do you mean?" "Only that if she could have, she would have. Wouldn't she?" Christian nodded slowly, raised his eyebrows as the implications of this theory sank in. He heaved his shovel into the hole. The root was thick. Cassandra pulled the other weeds aside and traced it a little higher. She smiled to herself, though it was worse for wear, devoid for the most part of leaves. She recognized this plant. She'd seen similar specimens in Nell's garden back in Brisbane. It was a wiry old rosebush. Had likely been here for decades. The stem was as thick as her forearm, covered in angry thorns. But it was still alive, and with some tending, would live to flower again. "Oh, my God." Cassandra looked up from her rose. Christian was crouched down, leaning into the pit. "What? What is it?" she said. "I've found something." The tone of his voice was odd, difficult to read. Electricity fired hot beneath Cassandra's skin. Something scary or something exciting?
Exciting, I think.
Cassandra went to kneel by him and peered into the hole. She followed the direction he was pointing. Deep down, amidst the moist soil, something had emerged from the muddy base. Something small, brown, and smooth. Christian reached down and eased the object free, withdrew a clay pot, the sort once used to store mustard and other preserves. He wiped the mud from its sides and passed it to Cassandra.
I think your garden just gave up its secret.
The clay was cool on her fingers, the pot surprisingly heavy. Cassandra's heart thumped in her chest.
She must have buried it here, said Christian.
After the man abducted her in London, he must have brought her back to Blackhurst. But why would Eliza have buried the clay pot after taking such a risk to reclaim it? Why would she risk losing it again? And if she had time to bury the pot, why hadn't she made contact with the ship? Retrieved little Ivory? The realization was sudden. Something that had been there all along became clear. Cassandra inhaled sharply.
What?
I don't think she buried the pot, Cassandra whispered.
What do you mean? Who did?
No one. I mean, I think the pot was buried with her. And for over 90 years she had lain here, waiting for someone to find her. For Cassandra to find her and unravel her secret. Christian stared into the hole, eyes wide.
He nodded slowly. That would explain why she didn't go back for Ivory, for Nell.
She couldn't. She was here all along.
But who buried her? The man who abducted her? Her aunt or uncle?
Cassandra shook her head. I don't know. One thing's for sure, though. Whoever it was didn't intend anyone to know about it. There's no gravestone, nothing at all to mark the spot. They wanted Eliza to disappear. The truth about her death to remain hidden forever. Forgotten. Just like her garden. Chapter 50. Blackhurst Manor, 1913. Adeline turned from the fireplace, inhaled suddenly so that her waist gathered tightly.
What do you mean things didn't go to plan?
Night had fallen, and the surrounding woods were converging upon the house. Shadows hung in the corners of the room, candlelight teasing their cold edges. Mr. Mansell straightened his pince-nez.
There was a fall. She threw herself from the carriage. The horses lost control.
A physician, said Linus. We must telephone a physician.
A physician will be of no assistance, Mansell's steady voice. She is already dead.
Adeline gasped.
What?
Dead, he said again. The woman, your niece, is dead. Adeline closed her eyes and her knees buckled. The world was spinning. She was weightless, painless, free. How was it that such burden, such weight, could lift away so swiftly? That one fell swoop could rid her of the old and constant foe, Georgiana's legacy. Adeline cared not. Her prayers had been answered. The world had righted itself. The girl was dead. Gone. That was all that mattered. For the first time since Rose's death, she could breathe. Warm tendrils of gladness infused her every vein. Where? She heard herself say. Where is she?
In the carriage.
You brought her here?
The girl,
Linus's voice drifted from the armchair in which he was enfolded. His breath was quick and light.
Where is the little girl with the flame-red hair?
The woman uttered a few words before she fell. She was groggy, and the words soft, but she spoke about a boat, a ship. She was agitated, concerned to get back in time for its departure.
Go, said Adeline sharply.
Wait by the carriage. I shall make arrangements, then call for you. Mansell nodded swiftly and left, taking the room's little warmth with him.
What of the child? Linus bleated.
Adeline ignored him, her mind busy racing towards solutions. Naturally, none of the servants could know. As far as they were concerned, Eliza had left Blackhurst when she learned that Rose and Nathaniel were relocating to New York. It was a blessing that the girl had spoken often of her desire to travel.
What of the child? Said Linus again.
His fingers quivered about his collar.
Mansell must find her. Find the ship. We must have her back. The little girl must be found.
Adeline swallowed a lump of thick distaste as she ran her gaze over his crumpled form.
Why? She said, skin turning cold. Why must she be found? What is she to either of us?
Her voice was low as she leaned close.
Don't you see? We have been freed. She is our granddaughter. But she is not of us. She is of me.
Adeline ignored the pale utterance. There was no need to comment upon such sentimentality. Not now that they were finally safe. She turned on her heel and paced the rug. We will tell people that the child was found on the estate, only to be stricken with scarlet fever. It will not be questioned. They already believe her ill in bed. We will instruct the servants that I alone shall tend her, that Rose would have wished it that way. Then, after a time, when every appearance of a proper struggle against the illness has been made, we will hold a funeral service. And while Ivory was receiving the burial befitting a beloved granddaughter, Adeline would ensure that Eliza was disposed of quickly and invisibly. She would not be buried in the family cemetery, that much was certain. The blessed soil that surrounded Rose would not be so polluted. She must be buried where no one would ever find her, where no one would ever think to look. The following morning, Adeline had Davies show her through the maze. Ghastly, damp place. The smell of musty undergrowth that never saw the sun pressed in on Adeline from all sides. Her black morning skirt swished along the raked ground, fallen leaves catching like burrs in the hem. She resembled a great black bird, her feathers gathered around her to ward off the chill winter of Rose's death. When they finally arrived at the hidden garden, Adeline brushed Davies aside and swept along the narrow path. Clusters of tiny birds took flight when she passed, twittering madly as they fled their hidden branches. She went as quickly as was properly permitted, anxious to be free of this bewitched place and the heady, fecund fragrance that made her head swoon. At the far end of the garden, Adeline stopped. A sharp smile thinned her lips. It was just as she had hoped. A cool shiver, and she turned suddenly on her heels. "I have seen enough," she said. "My granddaughter is gravely ill, and I must return to the house." Davies held her gaze a fraction of a second too long, and a shiver of trepidation slipped down her spine. Adeline quashed it. What could he possibly know of the deception she planned? "Take me back now." As she followed his large, lumbering form through the maze, Adeline kept her distance. She had one hand in the pocket of her dress, fingertips emerging at regular intervals to drop tiny white pebbles from Ivory's collection, the little jar in the nursery. The afternoon dragged, the night stretched hours past, and finally it was midnight. Adeline rose from her bed, pulled on her dress, and laced up her boots. Tiptoed along the hall, down the stairs, and out into the night. The moon was full, and she went quickly across the open lawn, keeping to the shadowy cool patches by the trees and bushes. The maze gate was closed, but Adeline soon had the clasp undone. She slipped inside and smiled to herself when she saw the first little stone, glistening like silver. From pebble to pebble she went, until finally she reached the second gate, entrance to the hidden garden. The garden hummed within its tall stone walls. Moonlight turned the leaves to silver, and whispering breezes made them jangle lightly, like pieces of fine metal. A quivering harp string. Adeline had the odd sense that she was being watched by a silent observer. She gazed about the moon-whitened landscape, drew breath when she noticed a pair of wide eyes in the fork of a nearby tree. An instant, and her mind filled in the blanks. The feathers of the owl, his round body and head, sharp beak. And yet she felt little better. There was something strange in the bird's stare, a worldliness. Those eyes, watching, judging. She looked away, refused to grant a mere bird the power to unsettle her. Noise, then, coming from the direction of the cottage. Adeline crouched by the garden seat and watched as two night-draped figures came into view. Mansell, she expected. But who was it he brought with him? The figures walked slowly, something large strung between them. They laid it down on the other side of the wall, then one of the men stepped across the hole and into the hidden garden. A sizzle, as Mansell struck a match, then a flash of warm light, an orange heart haloed by blue. He held it to the lantern wick and turned the dial so the light expanded. Adeline stood tall and made her approach. "Good evening, Lady Montrachet," said Mansell. She pointed at the second man and spoke with a chill voice. "Who is this?"
"Slocum," said Mansell. "My coachman."
"Why is he here?"
"The cliff is steep, the parcel heavy." He blinked at Adeline, the lantern flame reflected in the glass of his pince-nez. "He can be trusted not to speak."
He swung the lantern sideways and the bottom of Slocum's face came into view. The lower jaw horribly disfigured, lumpen nodules and pocked skin where a mouth should be. As they started digging, deepening the hole that the workmen had already made, Adeline's attention drifted to the dark shroud on the ground beneath the apple tree. Finally, the girl was to be relegated to the earth. She would disappear and be forgotten. It would be as if she'd never existed. And in time, people would forget that she had. Adeline closed her eyes, blocked out the noise of the wretched birds who had started to twitter keenly, the leaves that were rustling urgently now. She listened instead for the blessed sound of loose dirt falling onto the solid surface beneath. It would soon be over. The girl was gone, and Adeline could breathe. The air moved, cool on her face. Adeline's eyelids flew open. A dark shape coming towards her, right by her head. A bird? A bat? Dark wings beating the night sky. Adeline stepped back. A sudden sting, and her blood was cold, hot, cold again. As the owl coasted away over the wall, Adeline's palm began to throb. She must have exclaimed, for Mansell paused his shoveling to swing the lantern near. In the dancing yellow light, Adeline saw that a long, thorny rose tendril had wrested its way free from the flower bed to clutch at her. Its thick thorn was lodged in her palm. With her free hand, she plucked it from her skin. A bead of blood rose to the surface. a perfect, glistening droplet. Adeline withdrew a handkerchief from her sleeve. She pressed it to the wound and watched as the red stain seeped through. It was only a thorn. Never mind that her blood was ice beneath her skin. The wound would heal, and all would be well. But that rose bush would be the first item removed when Adeline ordered the garden raised. What business had a rose now in the Blackhurst Gardens? Chapter 51. Tregenna, 2005. As Cassandra stared into the deep hole, into Eliza's grave, she felt surrounded by a strange calm. It was as if with the discovery, the garden had breathed a great sigh of relief. The birds were quieter. The leaves had stopped rustling. The curious restlessness had gone. The long-forgotten secret the garden had been forced to keep had now been told. Christian's gentle voice, as if from somewhere distant. "Well, aren't you going to open it?" The clay pot, heavy now in her hands. Cassandra ran her fingers along the old wax that sealed the rim. She glanced at Christian, who nodded encouragement. Then she pressed and twisted, snapped the seal so that the lid could be prized open. There were three items inside, a leather pouch, a swatch of red-gold hair, and a brooch. The leather pouch contained two old coins, a pale yellow color stamped with the familiar jowly profile of Queen Victoria. The dates were 1897 and 1900. The hair was tied with a piece of twine and coiled like a snail's shell to fit inside the pot. Years of containment had left it smooth and soft, very fine. Cassandra wondered whose it was, then remembered the entry in Rose's early notebook, written when Eliza first came to Blackhurst. A litany of complaint about the little girl whom Rose described as little better than a savage. The little girl whose hair had been cut off as short and jagged as a boy's. The brooch Cassandra turned to last. It was round and sat neatly in the palm of her hand. The border was ornate, decorated with gems, while the center contained a pattern, a little like tapestry. But it wasn't tapestry. Cassandra had worked long enough amongst antiques to know what this brooch was. She turned it over and ran her fingertip over the engraving on the back. "For Georgiana Mountrachet," read the tiny print, "on the occasion of her 16th birthday. Past, future, family." This was it. The treasure for which Eliza had returned to the Swindles' house, whose price had been an encounter with a strange man. An encounter responsible for the separation of Eliza and Ivory, for all that had come afterwards, for Ivory becoming Nell. "What is it?" Cassandra looked up at him. "A mourning brooch." He frowned. The Victorians used to have them made from the hair of family members. This one belonged to Georgiana Mountrachet, Eliza's mother. Christian nodded slowly. "Explains why it was so important to her. Why she went to retrieve it. And why she didn't make it back to the boat." Cassandra studied Eliza's precious items in her lap. "I just wish Nell had seen them. She always felt abandoned, never knew that Eliza was her mother, that she was loved. It was the one thing she longed to learn, who she was." "But she did know who she was," Christian said. "She was Nell, whose granddaughter, Cassandra, loved her enough to cross the ocean, to solve her mystery for her." "She doesn't know that I came here." "How do you know what she does and doesn't know?"
She might be watching you right now. He raised his brows. Anyway, of course she knew you'd come. Why else would she have left you the cottage? And that note on the will, what did it say? How odd the note had seemed. How little she had understood when Ben had first given it to her. For Cassandra, who will understand why. And? Do you? Of course she did. Nell, who had needed so desperately to confront her own past in order to move beyond it, had seen in Cassandra a kindred spirit, a fellow victim of circumstance. She knew I'd come. Kristen was nodding. She knew you loved her enough to finish what she'd started. It's like, in the crone's eyes, when the fawn tells the princess that the crone didn't need her sight, that she knew who she was by the princess's love for her. Cassandra's eyes stung. That fawn was very wise. Not to mention handsome and brave. She couldn't help smiling. So now we know who Nell's mother was, why she was left alone on the boat, what happened to Eliza. She also knew why the garden was so important to her, why she felt her own roots connecting to its soil, deeper and deeper with each moment she spent within its walls. She was at home in the garden, for in some way she couldn't explain, Nell was here too. As was Eliza. And she, Cassandra, was the guardian of both their secrets. Kristen seemed to read her mind. So, he said, still planning on selling it? Cassandra watched as the breeze tossed down a shower of yellow leaves. Actually, I thought I might stay around a bit longer. At the hotel? No. Here in the cottage. You won't be lonely? It was so unlike her, but in that moment Cassandra opened her mouth and said exactly what she was feeling, gave no pause for second-guessing and worry. I don't think I'll be alone. Not all the time. She felt the hot, cold sensation of an impending blush and hurried on. I want to finish what we've started. He raised his eyebrows. The blush found her. Here, in the garden, I mean. I know what you mean. His gaze held hers. As Cassandra's heart began to hammer against her ribs, he let his shovel drop, reached out to cup her cheek. He leaned nearer, and she closed her eyes. A sigh, heavy with years of weariness, escaped her. And then he was kissing her, and she was struck by his nearness, his solidity, his smell. It was of the garden and the earth and the sun. When Cassandra opened her eyes, she realized she was crying. She wasn't sad, though. These were the tears of being found, of having come home after a long time away. She tightened her grip on the brooch. Past, future, family. Her own past was filled with memories, a lifetime of beautiful, precious, sad memories. For a decade she had moved amongst them, slept with them, walked with them. But something had changed. She had changed. She had come to Cornwall to uncover Nell's past, her family, and somehow, she had found her own future. Here, in this beautiful garden that Eliza had made and Nell had reclaimed, Cassandra had found herself. Kristen smoothed her hair and looked at her face with a certainty that made her shiver. "I've been waiting for you," he said finally. Cassandra took his hand in hers. She had been waiting for him, too.
Epilogue. Green Slopes Hospital, Brisbane, 2005. Cool against her eyelids. Tingles like tiny feet, those of ants, walking back and forth. A voice, blessedly familiar. I'll get a nurse. No. Nell reached out, still couldn't see, grasped for anything she could find. Don't leave me. Her face was wet, recycled air cold against it. I'll be back soon, I promise. No. It's all right, Grandma. I'm getting help. Grandma. That's who she was, now she remembered. She'd had many names in her lifetime, so many she'd forgotten a few, but it wasn't until she acquired her last, Grandma, that she'd known who she really was. A second chance, a blessing, a savior, her granddaughter. And now Cassandra was getting help. Nell's eyes closed. She was on the ship again, could feel the water beneath her, the deck swaying this way and that. Barrels, sunlight, dust. Laughter, faraway laughter. It was fading. The lights were being turned down. Dimming, like the lights in the Plaza Theatre before the feature presentation. Patrons shifting in their seats, whispering, waiting. Black. Silence. And then she was somewhere else, somewhere cold and dark, alone. Sharp things, branches either side of her, a sense that walls were pushing in on both sides, tall and dark. The light was returning, not much, but sufficient that she could crane her neck and see the distant sky. Her legs were moving. She was walking, hands out to the sides, brushing against the leaves and branch ends. A corner. She turned. More leafy walls. The smell of earth, rich and moist. Suddenly she knew. The word came to her, ancient and familiar. Maze. She was in a maze. Awareness, instant and fully formed. At its end was a most glorious place. Somewhere she needed to be. Somewhere safe, where she could rest. She reached a fork. Turned. She knew the way. She remembered. She had been here before. Faster now. She went faster. Need pushing in her chest. Certainty. She must reach the end. Light ahead. She was almost there. Just a little further. Then suddenly, out of the shadows and into the light, came a figure. The authoress, holding out her hand. Silvery voice. I've been waiting for you. The authoress stepped aside, and Nell saw that she had reached the gate. The end of the maze. Where am I? Your home. With a deep breath, Nell followed the authoress across the threshold and into the most beautiful garden she had ever seen. And at last, the wicked queen's spell was broken. And the young woman, whom circumstance and cruelty had trapped in the body of a bird, was released from her cage. The cage door opened, and the cuckoo bird fell, 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 until finally her stunted wings opened, and she found that she could fly. With the cool sea breeze of her homeland buffeting the undersides of her wings, she soared over the cliff edge and across the ocean. Towards a new land of hope and freedom and life. Towards her other half. Home. From The Cuckoo's Flight by Eliza Makepeace. acknowledgements. For helping to bring the Forgotten Garden into the world, I'd like to thank my Nana Connolly, whose story first inspired me, Selwa Anthony for her wisdom and care, Kim Wilkins, Julia Morton, and Diane Morton for reading early drafts, Kate Eady for hunting down pesky historical facts, Danny Kretzmer for providing photos on a deadline, and Julia's workmates for answering questions of vernacular. For research assistance, archaeological, entomological, and medical, I'm grateful to Dr. Walter Wood, Dr. Natalie Franklin, Catherine Parks, and especially Dr. Sally Wild. And for help with specific details, many thanks to Nicole Ruckles, Elaine Wilkins, and Joyce Morton. I am fortunate to be published worldwide by extraordinary people, and I'm thankful to everyone whose efforts have helped to turn my stories into books. For their sensitive and tireless editorial support on The Forgotten Garden, I'd like to make special mention of Catherine Milne, Clara Finlay, and the wonderful Annette Barlow at Allen & Unwin, Australia, and Maria Wright and Liz Cohen at Pan Macmillan, UK. I'm much obliged to Julia Stiles and Leslie Levine for their fine attention to detail. I would also like to pay tribute here to authors who write for children. To discover early that behind the black marks on white pages lurk worlds of incomparable terror, joy, and excitement is one of life's great gifts. I am enormously grateful to those authors whose works fired my childhood imagination and inspired in me a love of books and reading that has been a constant companion. The Forgotten Garden is, in part, an ode to them. Finally, as always, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to my husband, Davin Patterson, and my two sons, Oliver and Louis, to whom this story belongs. Belinda Audio hopes you enjoyed the reading of The Forgotten Garden, written by Kate Morton and read by Caroline Lee. For further information about the Belinda Audio range, please visit our website, www.belinda.com. If you liked this audiobook, please tell a friend. Kate Morton grew up in the mountains of southeast Queensland. She has degrees in dramatic art and English literature and is currently a doctoral candidate at the University of Queensland. Kate lives with her husband and young sons in Brisbane. Her first novel, The Shifting Fog, published internationally as The House at Riverton, was a number one bestseller in 2007. You can find more information about Kate and her books at www.katemorton.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.